Welcome to the Next Level Human Podcast. As a human, you have a job to do. In fact, you have four jobs: to earn and manage money, to attain and maintain health and fitness, to build and sustain personal relationships, to find meaning and make a difference. None of these jobs are taught in school, and that is what this podcast is designed to do: to educate us all on living our most fulfilled lives through the mastery of these four jobs. I'm your host, Dr. Jade Tita, and I believe we are here living this life for three reasons and three reasons only: to learn, to teach, and to love. In this podcast, I will be learning, teaching, and loving right along with you. I'm grateful to have your company. Here's to our next level. All right, everybody, welcome to today's podcast. I'm back with my two bros, Dr. Jeff Graham and Dr. Michael Donovan. Recurring, we want to be doing these recurring shows because we each come with sort of a diverse perspective, and there's a lot of overlap as well. And I think it just gives you all a chance to kind of see three experts kind of working through some of the issues that you all struggle with, especially as it pertains to information overload, information confusion, especially as it relates to diet and supplements. And so that's what we're going to really talk about today. How can we make sense of nutrition, supplementation with three guys who have been doing this for a while? So what's up, guys? Good to see you.
Hey, man. Good to see you too.
Glad to be back.
Glad we're back here.
Yeah, 100%. Well, let's start out. Now, whichever one of you want to go first, you know, I think it'd just be useful for people to hear your general way of conceptualizing nutrition for yourself and for the patients, clients you work with.
Take it away.
Yeah, man. So, you know, when I think of nutrition, I'm going to steal from Michael during our last time, man. I love the idea of nourishment, right? I think that was a really good point that, that we need to feel nourished by the foods we're eating. And for me, that nourishment, when I'm talking to folks, I'm trying to think about how you feel energetically and how, when you feel full, when you feel satiated, you know, there, as you mentioned, there are a thousand different ways to look at nutrition. And dear God, you know, what is it? I think I remember reading that there every day, just in this country, there's close to 100 nutrition papers put out, whether that's a meta-analysis, a study, a white paper, but you know, they're all often conflicting. And that's why one day in the news you see, hey, turns out butter's good for you. And the next day it's like, no, guess what? Butter's bad for you. So, it's conflicting. It's hard to dial in on. So I like to talk to my folks a lot about how full do you feel throughout the day with what you're eating right now. I think that can be a really easy way to check in with yourself and decide whether or not it's, you know, you're on this diet where you're leaving yourself in the tank, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hours later, or whether you're feeling like you have sustained energy and it's more just about kind of grazing throughout your day with a couple of bigger meals in there. One thing I do feel like we've gotten away from in this kind of, you know, carbs are poison attitude we've had for the last decade that has been largely propagated in the media, is the importance of micronutrients in our diet.
Yeah.
I can't tell you the number of patients I talk to that are, you know, like, oh man, you know, I tried keto and I felt great, but you know, I started realizing that my, I had these couple labs checked and my methylation numbers are off. You know, I've gone a little bit deeper on their stuff. I'm like, yeah, it's because, you know, you're lacking a lot of B vitamins there. You're missing a lot of these key metabolic, vitamins and coenzymes and support mechanisms that really help us to work as a next level human, mm-hmm. You know, someone who's actually functioning at their optimal level. Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. What about you, Michael?
Yeah. I think of, there's four F's that come to mind when I think of nutrition. There's fuel, there's function, there's fun, and there's fasting. Right. And so when we talk about fuel, we're talking about the macros, right? We're talking about calories. We're talking about the numbers side of things. Function is the performance side of things. As you said, micronutrients, those are vitamins mm-hmm. and minerals, right? Mm-hmm. Fun is taste, or I want a little jolt. And so I have, you know, even if it doesn't taste good, it's maybe it's a Red Bull or whatever, right? Yeah. And there's some, you know, maybe dopamine hit from it. Right. And then fasting is the timing, and it's not necessarily, we're all fasting at some point, right? Unless you're getting up and eating in the middle of the night, you're fasting during that time. And so we talk about intermittent fasting and, you know, multi-day fasts and things like that. But really to me, that's just the timing piece. And so there's the calories, macronutrients, performance, micronutrients, taste, and all of those kinds of things. And then the timing of when you eat things. And so that's, also, you know, just when we're talking about timing before and after workouts and things like that, I would put that under fasting. So I like to think of those four F's.
I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that as well. And I want to get into sort of talking about calories, and you know, that whole thing is a calorie. So we'll get into that. Remind me. And then I do want to talk about, you know, nutrition around workouts and timing too. When I think about this because of my work, and this is interesting, right? We all come from a different place. Most of my work has been around weight loss, physical transformation. And so when I think of nutrition, I tend to think of it from that perspective. And I tend to think of what we want to be doing is we want to be eating foods that are calorie sparse, yet nutrient dense. So that's the first thing. And then you want food that is hunger suppressing, because you don't want to be chasing around hunger and cravings constantly. And then I think you want food that is tasty enough, but not too tasty. Highly palatable hedonistic foods are going to cause you to overeat. And so from my perspective, that's how I look at it. Calorie sparse, nutrient dense, hunger suppressing, and tasty enough, but not so tasty, it's going to tend to make you overeat. And to me, I think that that is the basics. Now, of course, we talked last time about the idea of structured flexibility. So you come in with these models and you essentially say, I can look at my diet from these different parameters. And then, of course, I have to adjust. And Jeff, you alluded to this with, you know, like methylation numbers and, you know, different micronutrient status and whether you tend to lose a lot of salt or need more salt. And there's some, and, you know, I know, Jeff, if you all don't remember from last time, does a lot with genetic testing, which I think gets in to this aspect of nutrition. But I like the idea that we're starting broad, all of us, and then can begin to narrow down again, which goes back to that whole structured flexibility type of thing. But I unless you guys have anything else to say about that, I really do think that we should take on the calorie issue, because at least from if you look out there, there's so much that goes on. Calories matter, calories don't matter. Like, what's the deal with calories? Certain types of calories, macronutrients, are they more important than calories? All of these kinds of things. So any final thoughts on your general nutrition stuff? Then I just really want to hear what, you know, what you both think about the calorie debate.
Yeah, let's dive into calories.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'll just say one more thing, because I love what Michael, I love those four F's, man. I haven't heard that, but I like that framework a lot. And that made me think of, you know, the levers that I advise people around when I'm talking about nutrition in general. And, you know, it is kind of about, you know, the quantity, and that's where you can get granular with the qualities, like the, you know, what we're having, on a caloric intake a day, the quality. So what you're deciding to put in there, and then the timing, which is where fasting comes in, right? So as you alluded to, we get to do a lot of, I get to look at everybody's genes, and there are certain genetic tendencies and epigenetic tendencies that really tell us when timing may be the lever to pull, versus quality or quantity. But, that pulling too many of those at once, I think that's what people really get stuck in sometimes. You're going to decrease their quantity, decrease their overall energy intake while they're trying to ramp up their exercise, right? Really common thing that we see. And that usually does not lead to really good gains and performance for sure, right? Mm-hmm. And function. And oftentimes we'll throw off the hormonal balances that are so important at progressing us and towards our goals wherever we want to go. So, yeah.
Yeah. And just to piggyback on that, you know, I mentioned that last time, that our body doesn't react well to, or it doesn't notice small changes. It doesn't notice incremental changes, but it does notice very quick exponential changes, right? Yeah. And so, you know, when we talk about a diet designed to lose 1 pound a week or something like that, not only is it sustainable, but it keeps those hormones, right? We have satiety hormones, right, that are released in the gut or the brain, sometimes both, the gut-brain axis. And there are hormones that that cause us to begin eating, and then those that cause us to end eating, right? And those are orexigenic and anorexigenic hormones is the technical term for those. Yeah. And, you know, those don't respond. I mean, they ramp up really well. We don't want to lose weight evolutionarily, right? We want to maintain our weight, which it just in this environment that we live in, is kind of counterproductive, right? But to store fat has a benefit when you're, you know, when food is not abundant, right? And so our bodies are kind of designed to store fat, and those hormones have an important role in that. And so the more incremental we can you know, do things, whether it's, you know, on a meal by meal basis or a week by week or month by month basis, the more it allows those hormones to stay in that range where we want them to be and not get out of check, whether it's insulin, you know, on a meal to meal basis, or whether it's, you know, some of those orexigenic and anti-orexigenic hormones.
Yeah. What is like ghrelin? Is that one?
Ghrelin one is one that and most of these are tied to your circadian rhythm, right? Yeah. Ghrelin's released by the stomach and causes us to be hungry, we can dive into the hormonal side of things, but I think staying less technical is probably better.
Of course there's GLP-1, which is all the talk right now, and the GLP-1 agonist, which is an incretin released from the duodenum. So like, you know, we have this hormonal calorie debate, and you're hearing this a lot everywhere now, right? And of course I've gotten in trouble in my, because I wrote a book back in 2010 that really took on the whole calories versus hormone things. And at that time, it was relatively controversial, but now everyone's saying hormones over calories or calories over hormones. And from my perspective, I go, you can't separate these two things, right? Hormones impact calories, calories impact hormones. The things are important. I always like to say, though, you know, if you think hormones don't matter, then ask yourself, how many calories does sleep have and how many calories does stress have? Now, of course, we can't eat sleep and we don't eat stress, but we all know, everyone knows clinically, just in your own world, that many people, not all, because stress can have, depress appetite in some people, but most people understand if I don't get good sleep or I'm stressed out, it is going to dramatically impact my appetite, my energy, my cravings, and other things. And so I think it does tell us that calories and hormones are completely linked. I don't think you can separate the two, really.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So tell me about this. To get granular on the calorie thing, what is the question that you want to ask? Is a calorie,
It's kind of like this. I'll frame it up this way for you guys. So let's take an 8-ounce chicken breast, right? No skin on it. You know, boneless, skinless chicken breast, probably about 250 calories, 300 calories. Let's take a cruller donut from Dunkin' Donuts, right? Probably about 300 calories. Right now I ask the question, so people would say, yeah, a calorie is a calorie from a definitional standpoint, but those 300 calories are very different, right? We know that we could probably, the three of us can put down 5 cruller donuts if we wanted to and want more, but no one's going to eat 5 chicken breasts and feel like they can eat more. And that, I think, is the argument. So I'm curious how you both see this argument. Should we be, for example, just purely counting calories, or should we be looking at the quality of the food? It goes back to your quantity, quality sort of argument. Mm-hmm. And or is it different based on the individual? And I'm just curious how you all work around this stuff when you're getting questions around this, because some people do go, you know, I think a lot of people go, well, I'm eating healthy. Right. Mm-hmm. And then you go, well, those 5 handfuls of nuts you had like equate to 1,000 extra calories a day. And that matters. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, I'm cutting my calories down and I'm hungry all the time. And so it's like this idea of like, how do we find this balance? Yeah.
We'll be back after a quick break.
All right, time to talk about one of our sponsors. This one is one of my favorites. It's a long-time sponsor. You all know it. And if you don't, you are in for a treat. AG1. Now, for those of you who do not know AG1, I am very excited to introduce you to AG1 because it is one of the products that I've been taking for some time, and I take this almost every single day. It acts as my multivitamin. It acts as my probiotic. It acts as my green drink. It does a lot of different things. It's an antioxidant and it has adaptogen herbs in it. This is something I use straight up, a scoop in water. It's also something, surprisingly, that I put into my protein shakes. It does turn those protein shakes green, but the flavor is so neutral that I don't even notice it. And it is a great way to get all these nutrients in. The things I love about AG1 is all the things I just mentioned, but the fact that when you think about it, look at all the different products it replaces. Prior to AG1, I was taking a bunch of stuff and it has replaced 3 to 5 different products for me. And so I really love this product. It is what most people would consider a greens drink if you just looked at it, but it is so much more than that. Now, I've taken greens drinks in the past. Number one, they tend to taste like swamp water. I love AG1 because it's a very neutral, pleasant flavor. And the other thing is that many of these used to raise my blood sugar because they put other things in it, extra starches, tapioca starch in particular, and AG1 does not do that. The other thing about AG1 is it does testing constantly on keeping its product clean, and it is on its 50-plus iterations, so they keep making this product better and better. But look, don't take my word for it. Really, you should try the product. To get AG1, all you have to do is go to drinkag1.com/next level. drinkag1.com/next level. And they have a couple deals for you specific to that link. This is one of my favorite products. I urge you to get on AG1. It's going to be one of those things that you do for a very long time and be extremely beneficial for your health. Check the product out, drinkag1.com/next level, and let's get back to the show.
Yeah. There's a lot in there. You're right. I did this last time, and this is what I'm loving about this, Jade, by the way, is that this is the second time we've done this.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I hope we wander into some space where there's some controversial views here amongst us. But I love that example is right on, because if I like to look at this stuff again through an anthropologic lens. So if you think about, the signals we get when we consume a lot of protein, something like a chicken breast, something like, you know, maybe a couple of chicken, whatever you're into, but, it's the same thing I think about when you made a kill in the Serengeti 10,000 years ago, walking across there with your tribe. That's how our hormones have evolved, our signaling systems, until, again, like 100 years ago. Mm. You know, that's how we were genetically conditioned to release those hormones that make us feel full and stay full for a little bit, right? I love protein as a caloric intake source, and I do agree with you that, you know, things that are nutritionally dense and calorically not, is that how you put it?
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, and yeah. Calorically sparse. Yeah.
It's calorically sparse. We have to have some of that in our diet, but for me, I love the idea of these small inputs of protein throughout the day that are pretty consistent to keep us in hormonal balance and as a wonderful source of a slow burning calorie that induces satiety for longer.
Yeah, and we actually have research now that basically says there may not be an upper limit of protein. And they've done 3.3 grams per kilogram, right, which is greater than a gram per pound. And we're actually seeing no downside to that in hunger suppression and perhaps muscle gain and fat loss just from that, even at a recent study showing even at hypercaloric levels of protein, perhaps people are not gaining fat from that. So that's something that we should all continue to watch out for. But I love this idea, because I think more and more people are becoming savvy to it and what protein is actually doing.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, the thing that protein I tell patients all the time is it is essentially, if we're thinking about metabolic diseases, which is what I spend a lot of time dealing with. I know you do too. And I know it's always in the back of your mind, Michael, but the whole idea that, a protein is metabolically neutral. That's the way I explain it to patients. You know, carbs and fats, not necessarily, right? Some people, actually what we know about metabolic disease, developing insulin resistance, those kind of things. Now, for over 50% of Americans, at least, that is actually usually a fat-driven thing. These animal fats, a really high animal fat diet. So again, going back to the quality of that type of protein you're taking in can turn on those epigenetic factors that induce more insulin resistance and maybe hormonal imbalances with these kind of brain-gut relationships that Michael alluded to. So I think people, again, going back to the carb thing, sugar's gotten a really bad name here. But I think fats can be just as guilty with the epidemic that's sweeping not only America, but the world now. So, and protein does not fall into that, going back to these very basic macro categories.
Yeah. And think about this too, right? I'm going back to the anthropological stuff. Like, you know, I know hunters who bring me venison and stuff like that. And those animals are incredibly lean, right? And so there are periods of time. I know someone who hunted bear where he was like, there's times when the bear meat is so fatty, but it's a very narrow time of that bear fat is super fatty, and it's like late fall. Otherwise, they tend to be incredibly lean, and it reminds me of kind of what you're talking about as well, that if we look, it'd be very hard to find, you know, a very fatty animal as something that you could kill. Most of them are going to be incredibly lean.
Yeah. Eating off the forest floor. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what I tell my folks. Like, if you're eating something that's eating off the ground, it's usually, you're pretty safe there. Yeah.
Yeah. So, let's already dove deep.
Yeah. We're getting deep.
So I'm going to, first address carbohydrates and then protein. And I think with carbohydrates, again, the rule of three, I think we talk about processed foods, processed, especially carbohydrates. And really, like I emphasize, as I said last time, mostly eating and telling my clients to eat whole foods, right? And not the overpriced grocery chain, but unprocessed foods, right? And then we have processed foods, and then we have ultra processed foods, right? And things like even just rolled oats are processed food, right? Like you're not buying a bundle of oats from that are like, you know, shorn off the, from the field, right? Baby carrots are a processed food, right? They don't grow that way. Mm-hmm. Right. But that's not what we're talking about when we talk about processed food. And that's not what the headline means when it says processed food is, you know, intake is whatever. We're talking about ultra processed food, like bars and all the stuff. Ironically, those that are doing, you know, long distance endurance events are constantly eating to keep that quantity up, right? And so from a, you know, and those aren't the longest living people generally. Marathoners don't live longer than non-marathoners, right? They live longer than people that are sedentary, right? Yeah. But chronic disease and again, it goes back to the last time we talked about inflammation, right? And all of those kinds of things, eating ultra processed foods and high intensity for, you know, dozens of hours a week, exercise, both of those produce a lot of inflammation, right? And so that goes back again to the quality, and getting those, micronutrients, the anti-inflammatory, foods to counteract all that inflammation. So kind of strayed from carbohydrates there, but I think, I saw a study about a year ago that in college age students who, are not necessarily training for anything. I mean, but just that demographic was eating something close to 80% of their food, of their calories from ultra processed foods.
I believe it, ramen, you know? And all.
Right.
How much ramen?
Right. But if they're doing it at that stage, you know, they're growing into adults that are probably doing a similar
100%.
Thing, you know? And that was not the case 50 years ago. Right. And I think with a lot of the diets, right, like there's absolutely nothing, there's not necessarily anything right, but there's nothing wrong with the Zone diet or the South Beach diet or the, you know, choose your diet, right? And when they were initiated, when the books came out, because these all started as books, right, before they were fads, the books, as we talked about last time, it had a cutting phase where you cut out all the crap and then you introduce things back in, and it worked for people. And now if you take that book and you you try to follow it, if you followed it how they did, it would still work. If you follow it and you go to the store and you buy the branded products that they've developed around the South Beach and the Zone and the Atkins and all of this, right, it's not going to work as well because those diet fads from the last, 30 years were all founded on eating unprocessed foods and minimally processed foods. Mm. And when we're eating ultra processed foods, which is now what's been introduced in the, under those fads, it's not going to work. You're not going to lose weight. You're not going to get the results that you want.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Stephen Guiné out of Washington State University talks about this a lot. He has a book called The Hungry Brain. I don't know if you two have read that, but that particular book, it reminds me of kind of what you're saying here. And I always have, there was also a diet back in the day called the Shangri-La diet, which was essentially a bland diet. But anyway, Guiné talks about this idea of these highly processed foods. Obviously, they don't have the nutrients in them, but the other thing they do is have a very high flavor hit. You know, and so they are combining sort of the tastes and textures of the combination of fat and sugar and salt, and then add alcohol onto that, and you got this sort of cafeteria palatable diet that the average American, literally, in Guiné's work, is saying is driving the overeating, which I find really interesting because I remember the old study where they basically, this Shangri-La diet, the bland diet, where they would give people essentially a slurry of cream of wheat in a thermos that you couldn't see. And they said, eat as much of it as you want to eat. And after a few days, these people can only consume about 800 to 1,000 calories of this because the flavor centers in their brains were essentially not being pinged by this constant dopamine. So it brings up this other aspect of things, right, where it's this taste and texture and how that's communicating to our gut and nervous system and our brain causing us to eat more. And so that's a really interesting piece of this processed part of things. And I do think it goes back to, it is very easy to make a tasty food out of carbohydrates by adding sugar and or fat, and vice versa with fat. It's much harder with protein, right? Protein is going to have more of a normalizing effect. And think about it now. It's like I oftentimes think of the potato, and you look at least one study looks at the satiety index, which is highly controversial. The potato is like number one on that list in terms of hunger suppression. However, you start adding bacon and chives and sour cream and all these other things, or a potato chip. We all know those commercials. You can't eat just one. All of a sudden, that potato turns into a never-ending feast. And I do think it's a really important point that you're bringing up here that people are not aware of, not just because they're nutrient sparse, but because they are highly tasty, hedonistic foods, these processed foods. And that includes the Atkins bars and the paleo bars and all the things that we're starting to see now.
Well, it's no coincidence that most of these are chocolate covered, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I love, Jade, you mentioned that book, The Hungry Brain. I read that a while back, but it might have been that book. One thing that blew me away when I read that or a similar publication was the fact that they used the same kind of, when they were looking at functional MRIs of people's brains and how these foods light up, they used consultants from the gambling world. I mean, they said, hey, what do you guys use to keep people on these machines all day long?
Yeah.
Like, we want to see that pattern on this functional MRI to see what these foods are doing to people.
100%.
Right? I mean, that's mind-blowing that's the gambling industry has actually influenced, our nutritional intake.
Yeah, and I do think, you bring up such an important point, Michael, that I do think it is sneaking into the health food industry, right? It's like the health food industry is also a processed food industry. So we have to ask ourselves, and we even see this in things as simple as, whey protein versus pea protein versus casein. Different proteins are going to have different hunger suppressing effects based on how they're processed. And so it's just a really important, I think, thing for the listener to hear that maybe part of what's happening with their nutrition, which I'll throw this out and see what you guys think. I have a theory about the keto diet, let's say. There's two ways you can follow the keto diet, right? You can do it a kind of a whole foods way. It's a very creamy, umami flavored diet, right? So like if you follow the keto diet with you're just eating all the foods and not getting processed keto foods, you're going to be doing a creamy texture primarily and a very umami flavor diet. Hmm. However, then you start adding in the bars with stevias and even the natural sweeteners, and all of a sudden you're getting this flavor hit, this sweet hit that is telling your brain something different. I have seen clinically, I have no research to back this up, but I have seen clinically the people who do a keto-based diet just off the regular foods that are umami and creamy based, heavy creams, fatty meats, that kind of stuff, eggs, do better than the people who are doing these processed keto foods. And I'm wondering what you all think of that, because it does speak to this idea that we may be missing something very important by only focusing on macronutrients, micronutrients, and calories, when we think about the signaling that these textures and flavors are giving to us.
Yeah. I want to, I think we talked about this last time. So the adage, if you're doing it correctly and you're not getting the results, then you're not doing it correctly.
Yep. You're stealing that from Jade's book.
I was reading it the other day. I was just talking the other day about, like the history of Gatorade, right? Like not going anthropologically, right?
That's a great story.
But Gatorade, you know, was essentially made name for Gator because it was developed, as my, from my understanding, for the Florida Gator football team, right? In hot, humid weather, right? They were having some, you know, what we would say like electrolyte imbalance, right? And some cramping and things like that. And so I think it was a trainer or something, right? Developed a sports drink for these athletes, right? So if you ask yourself, I think this is the personalization, the individualization that we all, you know, kind of got to work with. Am I a football player in Florida in a you know, electrolyte deficient state? If the answer is yes, then reach for a Gatorade. If the answer is no, and you're sitting on your couch and you want a sugar sweetened beverage, and you feel bad about drinking a Coke, so you drink, you know, or soda, so you drink that as a soft drink, it's just another soft drink. It's just another, you know, high fructose corn syrup based drink, right? And these bars, you know, Clif bars were developed, you know, for, you know, when you're out on a trail and, you know, you're an hour or so in, you've already burned 500 calories and you want something to keep you going, right? Not when you're at your desk and you're typing and you, you know, check what's in the drawer. Oh, I have a Clif bar, you know? And so, you know, stocking your kitchen, right? Or your backpack or whatever, or your, you know, saddlebag if you're training for something, or your gym bag, right? With the things that are really going to fuel you for the purpose that you're, you know, what you're working towards, right? And so that then step back, clearly identifying what are you training for? What is your goal? Mm-hmm. And then you can align, you know, and I mean, this is just fundamental before we even dive into all the intricacies of, you know, how are you doing it right? What are you doing? Like, what is the what behind it before we figure out the how?
Yeah. What is your why? Yeah. So, I mean, you guys, you both hit on this because you mentioned, let's talk about a little bit of performance nutrition stuff. And then you already brought up the fact that so many of these foods that we do eat for performance are highly processed or at least processed. Well, I mean, how do you guys feel about that? You know, doing those kinds of, that kind of caloric intake in the middle of, say, a 2 or 3 hour run or a, you know, a training session that's keeping you in kind of a caloric deficit consistently as you're trying to continue going on.
Yeah, I think this is where you're going, Michael, and I think I agree with you. I think in that particular context, these things become health foods even. It's kind of like, take a Snickers bar, right? Like if you're starving to death and you've been out on the plains of Africa for 3 days and haven't eaten anything, a Snickers bar is a health food in that particular context, right? You know, so I think that, you know, in that case, when you're out there running, you know, and doing these hard workouts, and, you know, you could take, and we actually see this, again, the anthropological stuff, Herman Ponzer's work shows this. I mean, the Hadza will climb up a tree, eat as much honey as they can possibly get, you know, just pure infusions of simple carbohydrates because they've been out in the heat all day. They're moving so much. It's a whole different thing than, you know, guzzling down a Gatorade or a Coke or something like that when you're not actually doing anything. So I do think this matters. And I do think there's a place for this. Of course, we have to be careful because we have a lot of people who will do that and then punish themselves with exercise to try to cancel out what they're doing. But I do think there is a time and a place for processed foods for guys like us, especially you two who are a little bit more endurance oriented than I am. I think that can be powerful. I think it is a slippery slope, though, right? Because of the hedonistic effects, you can easily overdo these things. And I do think there's what I would call nutrition creep sometimes. And how I would explain this is someone goes on a keto diet. They drastically increase their fat intake. They go off the keto diet, but now all of a sudden they're into bacon and eggs and butter, right? And so all of a sudden there's this creep that happens where now they're back on a standard American diet that is higher in fat than it would be otherwise. And so these are the things that I think actually you know, happen in real life. But to answer your question, I do think there's a time and a place for this, especially for guys who are training hard.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I agree. I and this is spoken somewhat, you know, anecdotally from personal experience. I mean, there are times when a freaking, you know, caffeine loaded gel has saved my life, you know, on mm-hmm. 3 hours into it, you know, something I'm like, oh God, I didn't bring enough. And, you know, that's usually the last thing I'm having. So I'm trying to actually eat some real food when I'm out there a little bit, you know, to your point. But yeah, I think I agree 100%.
Yeah. I'd say two things. I think, like, let's say you're beginning to train for your first marathon, or you're going to do a century ride or a half Ironman triathlon. All those are kind of around in the same time frame. Ironman's a whole different game. 5K, you probably don't need to eat anything. But you know, you're training, let's say, you know, 10, a dozen hours a week or so. You don't want to get to the starting line and be nervous. Like you know, you're putting in the time, right? So you're doing a 2 hour ride. I would say you probably don't need anything. Hmm. And I think if you, an hour into every workout, have a bar, you have a gel, an hour into your race, your body's going to be expecting it.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I'm not talking about, we could go down that path as well, about training in a fasted state. You know, what if I, you know, do my workouts at 6 a.m. and I haven't had anything, you know, before. I don't really think it matters. And I think it's actually good to train your body to preferentially burn fat, to preferentially burn the most abundant, you know, that you can carry, because your glycogen stores can only, you know, carry you so far. And if you're pushing, especially in a racing standpoint, if you've only trained your body to depend on the carbohydrate that you have, whether you're taking it in or whether you're burning your glycogen stores, you're going to have a huge fat reserve that you're never going to be actually able to access. And so from a, you know, we use in you know, CrossFit, I think, kind of popularized the term metabolic conditioning, mm-hmm. right? And we're conditioning our metabolism in this case to actually use the fuel source that has the most number of calories. I mean, most people are walking around with days worth, weeks worth of calories in their fat, right? But only a few days, maybe one day worth of calories in carbohydrate. Okay. So, you know, in a rested state, right? And any really, I mean, we talk about the fat burning zone as if it has a bottom level, right? We're in a fat burning zone right now, just sitting, right? And so there's an upper level to the fat burning zone where if you go above that, you start to produce lactate, you start to preferentially, you know, you're always burning a little bit of carbohydrate, but your ratio shifts when you're getting in that high intensity. And even if you're just going up a hill or going up a flight of stairs, you're burning just a little bit more carbohydrate. But up until that threshold, we're mostly burning fat. Right. And so to teach the body to burn fat while we're training then allows us to perform better on race day by burning, you know, whatever that ratio needs to be. And it probably will be a little bit more carbohydrate because we're pushing a little bit more. We're going at race pace, not training pace. And, you know, it depends on the sport and things like that. But it's not easy to eat when you're running as it is when you're biking. Right. Yeah. And so you don't see a lot of triathletes, like they're trying to get as many. It's also very difficult to eat when you're swimming. So you don't see, you know, most triathletes that I've worked with and in my experience, I'm trying to eat as much as I can on the bike because it's a lot easier to digest and to eat than when you're bouncing around and, you know, you have things jostling around in your stomach. So you don't want to go into that final leg of a tri, you know, feeling depleted. You want to feel, you know, as you also don't want to feel, you know, bogged down with eating too much food. But I think the more you can burn, we just have a tremendous amount of fuel reserve in our fat. And so I think from a training standpoint, leveraging that as much as we can is important. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that because I also think it speaks to the fact that this confusion that people feel like they have to have some kind of sports drink or a meal or something during their workouts. With most people who are just training to look good, not perform better, this also matters, right? Because it's like, I think we would probably all agree that I don't see a benefit in that at all with people eating things while they're training, if they're just training to look good, right? It's like that to me seems incredibly counterproductive. And I do like that idea of increasing metabolic flexibility through how you train. Yeah. Now, of course, we could talk about timing about what we do after that, because we also know, and this is just a, to throw a wrinkle in this, we also know that 75% of people, based on the research that I've, I talk about this that in my book, is that perhaps upwards of 75% of people respond to exercise with increased hunger. Mm-hmm. And this may be more prevalent in women. And so then we have this certain thing where, okay, so if you're just training to look good, we don't necessarily want you eating things before your workout, but there might be an opportunity for us to time things a particular way after the workout to help suppress some of this hunger craving response that many people get. And not everybody, of course, but it seems a lot of people. And then actually, there was actually just, I think, in USA Today or some one of the popular magazines just last week, a rat study showing that they actually figured out the mechanism by how this is working in rodents. But we've seen this in adults for a while. So I'm wondering what you all think about that, the two of you. And then is there anything that you might say about, you know, timing nutrients after and food after workouts and how that might work for an athlete or for someone who's just trying to lose weight?
We'll be back after a quick break.
All right. Time to break into the show for one of our sponsors. This is a brand new sponsor, and there is a lot of neat research around this product that you're going to want to listen to and pay attention to. The product is Qualia Senolytic. This product helps to address one of the key discoveries of the last decade in regard to aging. As our cells age, many of them begin to become arrested in their development. These cells stop dividing. They become senescent cells, kind of like zombie cells, right? These cells that are just hanging around, no longer dividing and secreting negative compounds that have negative effects on the body. This is a product, Qualia Senolytics, that addresses this effect. Now, you might think, well, okay, well, what about exercise and diet and fasting and cold plunges and all these things? Aren't these things going to help with this? Well, here's the interesting thing. We all age, right? No matter what you do, we all know that we're going to age and you're going to see the signs of aging. Research is suggesting this is because of these senescent cells and all these things I just mentioned, fasting, proper diet, exercise, all these things seem not to make much of a difference when it comes to these senescent cells. So how do we get rid of these zombie cells and help that middle age feeling that a lot of us get after we turn 40? I know I did. That's what this product, Qualia Senolytics, does. It's like pruning the yellowing leaves off of a dead plant. It removes worn out senescent cells to allow for the rest of the body to begin to thrive. And all you need to do is use this compound 2 days a month, 6 capsules one day, 6 capsules the next day, and you will get the effects of these senolytic agents to remove these zombie cells from the body. The formula is non-GMO, it's vegan, gluten-free, and the ingredients are meant to complement one another, factoring into the combined effect of all these ingredients together. Not only that, this product comes with a 100-day money-back guarantee. If you don't begin to feel higher energy levels, feeling younger, more productive, and more enthusiastic, and especially what happened to me, less aches and pains. How do you get this product so you can take advantage of getting rid of these senescent cells? All you have to do is go to neurohacker.com/human. And when you do, you'll get up to $100 off. When you use the code HUMAN at checkout, you'll get an additional 15% off. That's neurohacker.com/human and use the code HUMAN on checkout. Look, aging is one of those things that is incredibly difficult to do, even when we're doing all the right things with diet and exercise and fasting and all the tools we know. This is one of those products that is insurance on helping us age better. Check out Qualia Senolytics, neurohacker.com/human, and let's get back to the show.
Mm-hmm.
I love that you brought up metabolic flexibility. You mentioned metabolic conditioning, which CrossFit popularized, of course, but flexibility is something I talk to my folks a lot about. So hit on that real quick first. But I do think that, because it kind of comes back to this question of timing, I believe, and I can't remember the last patient I didn't tell this, that a 12-hour fasted time out of every 24-hour cycle is 100% crucial,
yeah.
Right? Like whatever you're having in between there, we can get granular about that, but that helps induce this metabolic flexibility. And unless, as Michael referenced, you're getting up at 2 a.m. to eat every night, you know, this is fasted time. And so if you can cut your food off, you know, 3 hours before you lay down to go to bed, hopefully you're getting close at least to that 12 hours. And that really helps to start work that fat burning engine up and get you more comfortable with being in that fasted state. You know, I tell people, too, it's okay to be hungry. I feel like that's gotten a lot of things like, I bet you can't eat just one. And, you know, it's hungry, you know, every other commercial, if you're watching mainstream TV, you're hungry. It's all about food and what we should be treating this symptom almost of hunger. Hunger is very normal, right? It's a signal that we experience a lot. And so we talk a lot to our patients. And one things our health coaches do is just a lot of building that mental framework around allowing yourself to be hungry and realize, hey, I'm okay right now. Everything's okay.
Yeah, it's like a feeling. You need to be able to control it.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You can't control it if you never feel it.
That's right. That's exactly right. Timing around exercise, though, I tell people, you know, in this 2-hour window after exercise, and I'm ready to say something that's going to get Michael to really tell me I'm wrong here. I love being wrong about these things so I can learn something. But I tell folks, you know, in that 2-hour window after exercise, that pretty much open game with what they eat. You know, I don't want them to go out and just, like you said, slam, you know, get a dozen donuts on the way home, but to make sure they're getting a macronutrient and micronutrient rich meal during that time. Interestingly, in the research I've read, you know, I think a lot of people prioritize protein right after that. I don't know that that's that important. I'd love for you to tell me I'm wrong here, but what I'm aware of is that it's really about definitely including a protein dense, you know, portion of that is good, but that's also a great time to get a lot of healthy carbohydrates in, not worry as much about what you're eating in that window. So if I'm talking to someone who's embarking in both of these paths, hey, I'm ramping up my exercise, but I also want to really work on the timing or quantity of what I'm having. I'm like, hey, that's a 2-hour kind of free zone for you. You know, when you leave the gym or get off the bike.
You're definitely uniquely insulin sensitive at that area,
yeah,
right? So it's
exactly.
A whole different metabolic state.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. That's what I tell people. Like, this is a time when your levels of, you are ready, like your body is primed to take on calories right then. So you can feel safe in that time. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we're being a little bit reductionist in terms of talking about macros and micros,
yeah,
in exclusion of each other in silos and you know, that can be helpful. But I think if we talk about like a 2000 calorie diet, the nutrition labels are based on, right? And we take maybe an 80-20 perspective to that, like 1600 of those calories should be as, you know, ideally maybe as nutritious as possible, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and then 400 kind of enjoy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. And if we're trying to lose weight, if that's kind of where your basal metabolic rate is, you're offset, right? You're not gaining or losing weight at that 2000, which is not most people. Most people are not at that average, and that's just kind of for simplicity what they came up with. You know, easily, if you're training, especially endurance wise, you could be 4000 calories a day, right? And does that mean we now need to, with that 80-20, now we need to get 3,200 calories of high quality and, you know, 800 of, well, that's going to be a little bit more difficult, because if we're talking about salad and broccoli and, you know, nutrient dense, calorically sparse foods, we're not going to have any time to train, because we're just going to be eating these fiber-rich, you know, yep, nutrient-rich foods, right?
Not to mention gut function as you're trying.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, exactly. And then, I mean, 4,000, that's a low number, right? If you're training for you know, actually, I mean, probably just one gym session is going to get some of us in the room up to that level, right? So we're talking 6,000, 8,000. I mean, I do mountain bike rides where I've been out for 11 hours, right? So, I mean, that's a huge number. I'm not eating salad on the bike, you know, I'm not. So there is a role for these these more processed foods, right? These less nutrient dense foods. And then if you're going down on the spectrum, you know, you want to lose weight, maybe you're cutting down to like 1500 calories for a little bit of time. Right. And you still though on that, in that case, maybe you're cutting out less of those, you know, reward calories because you do need those vitamins and minerals. You know, there's some basal level where we don't want to go below. I mean, it's very unusual except for iron or some of these kinds of things to we're not getting scurvy anymore. You know, there's not nutrient deficiencies because everything is fortified. I mean, the beyond bars, I mean, every cereal you could eat Trix or Fruit Loops every day and there's, you know, they take it out, but they put the nutrients back in a supplemented form. You know, foreshadowing a little that, sprinkling a little supplement because we want to go in that direction. But, you know, we're not in a nutrient, deficient state. Yeah. You know, we may benefit from a little bit of enhancement through some kinds of supplements or eating more foods or things like that. But I think, quality, is the goal ultimately. And I'll just say on this, I remember a study again from my grad school days. It was a nutrition class where they were talking about, using whole foods, not supplements, to ameliorate, anemia. So it was people that were lacking in iron, right? And so they said, how many bowls of spinach do they need to eat for 90 days, let's say, to raise their, like, without supplementation, right? And this was back in the 60s, let's say. And so it was like two big salads of spinach every day for 90 days. And then they repeated it later, maybe 20 years later. So it was like in the 90s, and it didn't work. They're like, we followed the protocol exactly and it didn't work. And they measured the iron in the spinach and it wasn't the same as it was 20 years before.
Wow. That makes complete sense.
And so when we talk about organic, this is a point that I like to make with a lot of my clients. It's, well, a lot of times when we talk about organic and, you know, it's true of protein as well. When we talk about grass fed and free range and all these kinds of things, right? It's not necessarily that it's the pesticides on the spinach that we're avoiding, right? It's what's not in it that is important, not just what is on it, you know? And so what happens with the, you know, and I don't eat all organic to be transparent, but the quality, not just from a taste perspective or things like that, but a carrot is not a carrot, is not a carrot, you know, like two carrots, they may look the same, but if you actually measure the nutrients in them, they're not necessarily the same.
Yeah, anyone who's been to Italy knows you take a tomato from Italy versus a tomato from the United States, it's a whole different ball game.
Right. And you can taste the difference. But I think especially foods that are grown in the ground or, you know, very close to the ground, right? If you spray pesticides on them, those go, you know, and it rains and they're you know, through the agriculture process, all of that leaches into the soil, right? And that's where it's getting the nutrients, is from the soil, right? And any you know, gardener at home knows that, like the soil leads to the vegetables, you know? And so the quality of the soil leads to the quality of the fruits or vegetables. And so that's why it's important, especially on these things that you're going to eat a lot of, to eat the highest quality because they're the most nutrient rich. And, you know, what, if it doesn't come with a label, we really don't know what's in it, you know, and it may taste better and, you know, maybe we're drawn to it for that reason. But yeah, all things are not created equal in fruits and vegetables.
And it makes me think of the practicality of all this, honestly, because if you think about, you know, what we actually do as humans, we eat about the same 10 foods daily. Right. We eat the same meals over and over again. So it does give us an opportunity as clinicians and as individuals listening to this, is that those 10 meals, pay attention to those 10 meals. That's what you're typically eating over and over again anyway. So pay very close attention to that. That's my first thought. Then my other thought is that I think we can say, and I talk about this in my book about metabolic toggles, this idea of eat more, exercise more. If you're exercising more, then you need to eat more. And some of that eating more can indeed include some of these processed foods. And we shouldn't be afraid of them because you're not going to be able to get the nutrition and calories anyway, unless you do that. So I do think it's reframing this eat less, exercise more approach. If that's the only approach you have, then you look at everything through that lens, and you have athletes looking at it through that lens. When an athlete does not want to be eating less and exercising more, in fact, the best athletes in the world would never do that.
Never.
Right? They would never do that. They eat more to fuel the exercise. And so I do think we need to start expanding this conversation to, it's not eat less, exercise more. It's also eat more, exercise more at times. And then there's sometimes where it's eat less, exercise less, like a hunter-gatherer might do, right? And so we have to begin to be a little bit more nuanced in these conversations, what I think you're both alluding to with the idea of an athlete and what they're putting in their bodies.
It's a great point. And I think one thing that I'll just add is sometimes people, especially when they're in a caloric deficit, right, they may actually, the counterintuitive thing that just blows people's mind is when I recommend eating more to lose weight.
Yep, reverse right? dieting kind of.
Because when your body goes into, again, evolutionarily, when it goes into conservation mode, it holds on to every calorie you give it, right? When it goes into starvation mode. And so you can kick it out of that mode by eating more, and it, you know, your body to personify is basically like, oh, we don't need to be as greedy with these calories.
Mm-hmm. If we see the metabolism as a stress sensing and responding apparatus, this makes sense, right? Because one of the things it's going to do is it's going to measure the gap between calorie intake and output, and that gap, whether it's I'm eating a ton and not exercising, or whether I'm exercising a ton and not eating, that gap is going to grow, and our stress mechanism registers that gap, which is why we have dieters and, you know, chronic exercisers and couch potatoes. All of them, they both have hunger, they both have cravings, they both have unpredictable low energy, because it's the same response happening, because that gap in calorie intake and output is increased. And I think that's what's happening. I think it's a stress mechanism. Whether you're a couch potato or whether you're a chronic exerciser who's not eating enough, that calorie gap is going to cause issues.
We'll be back after a quick break.
All right. Well, I have a new partnership to announce that I am very excited about. And this partnership is with the Next Level Human company, ButcherBox. I consider them a Next Level Human company because they are doing everything they can to source the best quality meats, as well as source those meats from companies and farmers that are committed to sustainable and regenerative animal husbandry, raising animals in the way that they are naturally supposed to be raised and doing right by the environment. And it is just what it sounds like, a butcher box. Imagine you had a butcher right down the street from you that put a box together for you of all the best quality meats that you could find. And that is what Butcher Box does. They send them frozen right to your door. And the animals are the highest quality, 100% grass-fed and grass-finished beef, never given antibiotics or hormones, humanely raised. Grass-fed beef is an incredible source of omega-3 acids, vitamins, and minerals. It is one of the healthiest foods on the planet. Not only is the beef superior, but they also raise crate-free pork that are humanely raised. Also, never with antibiotics or hormones in any of their meats. They also really pay special attention to their chicken. These are pasture-raised chicken, heirloom breeds. This means ancient breeds, wild breeds. They never give them antibiotics or hormones, and these are free-ranging animals that can run out in the pasture and eat all of the worms and bugs and everything else to make their meat incredibly healthy. And they also do free-range turkey and wild-caught seafood. And this seafood is wild-caught, sustainably harvested, no artificial coloring, no additives, just straight from the sea. Your health is going to get better, and it is much better for the environment. If you want to get involved, there are two ways to do this. One, you can go to drj.com/butcherbox, and you can choose between three curated boxes, or you can do what I do, which is make your own box. That's drj.com/butcherbox. ButcherBox. And when you sign up using that link, you can choose between a free year of salmon, a free year of ground beef, or a free year of chicken breast. I love ButcherBox. I use them myself. I am so excited that they are now sponsoring the podcast. drjade.com/ButcherBox. And let's get back to the show.
I tell you, one of the ultimate paradoxes that really sucks for the, I love you mentioned women before and kind of getting more gender specific about this, this optimal energy availability or OEA that's become a really popular and well-researched phenomenon now since I think the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, published on in 2022, published like a 107-page statement about what a kind of epidemic this is becoming. And the whole idea that, you know, especially for females, like what you're saying, Michael, their optimal energy availability is usually going to be around 45 to 50 kilocalories per kilogram of body weight per day, as opposed to males who can actually get by on 35, 40, maybe up to 45, you know, kilocalories per kg per day. So when you work that out, when I'm talking to a, and this is going to be more, impactful in those perimenopausal years for women in the 40s and 50s. So, you know, and unfortunately they get this message because our society sends this message all the time. You got to look this certain way. You got to, you know, you got to cut calories and exercise more to be in the right shape. And it really, I think we have really solid research to back up what you're saying right now that actually, especially for females, oftentimes it's a problem of increasing calories to decrease that stress response in the body that's resulting in higher insulin levels and more cortisol circulating that's going to put you in this fat storage mode because you're sending that message that, hey, we're on the Serengeti. We got a pride of lions chasing us and we haven't seen food in a couple of days because we can't stop to hunt, right? So
100%. And actually, if you look at Herman Ponzer's work and Epple's work, they both look at Herman Ponzer's work is the work on basically some of this, the idea that exercise calorie burn is not additive, it's constrained. Mm-hmm. So I'll just briefly explain it to the listeners and you guys can comment on it. But basically what that means is we usually think that if our basal metabolic rate is we burn 2,000 calories at rest and we go for a 300 calorie workout, what we think is we burn 2,300 calories, right? What Herman Ponzer's work shows is that after a couple of weeks, your budgeting, your basal metabolic rate starts to budget. And so you're right back at 2,000 calories again. Hmm. And so that's the first thing that's happening. And there is some indication that women may have more of this response compared to men. And then the other thing is the idea of hunger and craving responses in regards to exercise, which also women may be having more of that response. And this would make sense simply that they are the gender of child bearing. Mm-hmm. And so this would make sense from a stress stat perspective that they're going to be a little bit more sensitive and refined in how they manage their caloric reserves. And we are seeing this. It's not conclusive yet, but we're seeing this being hinted at in the research that women may get more of a constrained metabolism through exercise. They also may be getting more of a hunger craving response with exercise. Of course, this is you know, individualized, but it does bring up a really interesting thing because back to the hormone conversation, you know, when progesterone kicks in after the luteal phase, that does make the body more insulin resistant. It does make it a little bit more stress reactive than when estrogen levels are higher, estrogen kind of being the female equivalent of testosterone plus. It's kind of a much more nuanced hormone than testosterone, but it's a beautiful discussion because I think it does start to go. Yes, there are differences between men and women, you know, and yes, we have to, you know, maximize this individuality between, you know, each person, you know, so it's a really powerful thing to begin to look at. And I think does begin to explain a lot of what we might see in terms of complaints that women have versus complaints that men have around dieting and performance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And not just performance, just body composition changes, right? 100%. I'm not getting where I want to be. And well, you're underfeeding yourself. Yeah. So yeah. Thoughts, Michael?
Yeah. I just want to zoom out again.
You were taking that in. Okay.
Yeah. I just want to zoom out a little bit, again, and kind of look at why we're eating and how we're eating and why the importance of those. And so I think why we're eating, energy versus hunger, right. Or boredom or stress. Mm-hmm. Right. But you know, when someone is exercising a lot, You know, especially like doing long distance running or biking or whatnot. A lot of times you don't have that much appetite. You know, when you're actually doing that activity, right? And so, I think if you're really mindful and you dial in to you know the body sensation, you rarely feel hunger in your belly, right? But you might feel like, wow, I'm low on energy, you know, and that's the state that I've sort of been in for the last couple decades. I think is that what cues me to eat is when I feel low on energy. I don't generally feel it in my belly, but when you're eating a lot of processed foods and things like that, and especially when your blood sugar spikes up and then crashes down, you do feel it in your belly, you know? And so that's one thing. And then I think how we're eating really matters too. And whether we're being mindful or whether we're multitasking, right? Are we scarfing something down while we're continuing to work through lunch, right? Are we sitting down, either by ourselves or with others? And, you know, are we eating socially or solitarily? You know, that and just the speed at which we're eating, all of these actually, I think, matter to our body, you know, whether they're the priorities for us. That matters how it's digested and absorbed, and so these are important considerations. I'm not trying to make it even more complicated, actually trying to just back up away from all of the minutiae and just...
Well, you're personalizing it a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, ask yourself these questions. Why are you eating right now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And beyond the what should you eat and how should you eat, just like when you're sitting down to a plate of food, you know, regardless of what's on it, what is that process? And, you know, we could look at fitness and performance in the same way, you know, just like what are the big picture things that often get overlooked?
Yeah. 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 I think it might be a good time for us to go ahead and start wrapping it up and just kind of give our takeaways in terms of what we would want people to take away from this discussion or what we think are the most important things. And I hope you all listening can kind of get, it's like, you know, when you're talking to three experts around this, it can seem to get deep into the weeds at times, but that's why I think it's good that you brought this up, Michael, just to kind of pull back and go, okay, so how can we make sense of this then? What are the most important components? And I don't know, Jeff, you want to kind of just wrap up your thoughts and then we can go around the room?
Yeah, man, I think you can say it in two words that you guys have already brought up, but it's metabolic flexibility. And for that to, you know, I think, again, I like going back to those three levers, thinking about the quality, quantity, and the timing. And so for me, I am a big believer in spending some time at a fasted state. Mm-hmm. Because as you referenced, Jade, we are incredibly efficient homeostatic machines. We adjust to things quickly, right? So that it's going to be important every now and then to throw some shockwaves into your body around what you're doing. So I'm a big fan of spending some time in a fasted state. I tell a lot of my folks to, you know, hey, one day a month, try and work up to a 24-hour fast, you know, and for some people, if there are medical reasons, maybe more often. But I think whatever you can do to induce more metabolic flexibility into your life, introduce that that concept more, you're going to end up succeeding. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know how I can improve on that, because I would 100% say the same thing, Jeff. Quality, quantity, timing. I love the idea of, like, you know, we have all this fasting stuff. To me, I'm like, everyone should be doing a 12-hour fast. There should be equal time with and without food. Mm-hmm. And just to add things onto that, I would just say, you know, one of the things I think is very important about this is that if you are an athlete, don't get it twisted with eat less, exercise more. There are other ways to approach this. For you, you're probably going to want to do eat more, exercise more. And then, you know, listening to what Michael said about, and when you do that, you may need to focus on calories at times when you're really outputting a lot of energy and not worry so much about, you know, all the high quality foods. Get those in. But once you start really ramping up your exercise, you want to be in that eat more, exercise more sort of category. And I think that's really, you know, about it from my perspective on this. We can talk about supplements at other times, but to me, you know, a good multivitamin, maybe some fish oil, you know, some basic things. I think that's pretty much where I would be come down on this.
Cool. I think I'll just add one more thing that we haven't talked about, which is variety. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think when you're beginning anything, whether it's an exercise regimen or eating or, you know, dieting, changing things in a healthier direction, consistency is really important. But then you reach a plateau, right? Whether it's, you know, your strength or your diet. And even eating the healthiest foods, whatever, you know, you could, the top dozen healthiest foods, if you eat just those 365 days a year, you're probably missing some things that you could get from other foods. Mm. Right. And so I think, you know, how do you do that? Easily, you eat more seasonally. In the winter, eat more grounding foods and you know, warming foods. And then in the summer, eat more cooling foods. That's an easy way to do it. Another way to do it is to go to the farmer's market and buy what's local, you know, and I think, that's more important to me, proximity rather than eating organic and things like that. But if you eat locally, if you live in an area where there's a lot of agriculture like California or here in the South, and then, or just buying on sale. Because the grocery stores are getting things often locally, or they're getting what's abundant in that season, and it tends to be cheaper, and they pass that savings on to you through those items being on sale. And so, you know, as you're walking through the grocery store, just, you know, I always like to, at the farmer's market or at the grocery store, just get something every time I go, get something that I didn't get last time.
Yeah. Something new.
Like, yeah. Just seen that vegetable. Well, that's right. That's right. Yeah. And, you know, with that seasonality, they roll, you don't see, and I think that's, you know, we can now get strawberries year round. We can now get these things. They're not very good in the off season, you know, cause they're coming from Chile or whatever, but the strawberries from Watsonville, California that are greenhouse or grown are better. And then the ones that are grown in, you know, in a farm down the road
South
are
Carolina.
Are amazing. Even better, you know? Yeah. So that the variety I think is important, and we didn't really touch on that before. So that's where I'll leave it.
Yeah. So I got two more questions for you guys. One question is, I'll ask both of you, and then I want you to tell people where they can find you. But what's the number one meal that you eat? Like, if you had to say the meal I eat most often, Jeff, like, what would it be?
Honestly, man, sardines.
Sardines.
Yeah. I think I probably
super nutrient rich, healthy food.
Eat a can every day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Already had them this morning.
Yeah. How about you, Michael?
I love kicking off my day with right now it's eggs.
Yeah.
Just getting that protein in and mixing in some veggies or you know, leftovers from the night before, and just making sure that the day starts with a high protein meal.
Yeah, and for me, it's probably chicken breast on a low carb tortilla with arugula. Like, I pretty much crush that.
It's a staple.
Yep. Like pretty that. Much all the time. That's and it good. Changes, you know. Yeah. But anyway, Dr. Michael Donovan, Dr. Jeff Graham, where can they find you, Michael? I know people are going to want to get in touch with you. We talked about this last time.
Sure. MichaelDonovanCoaching.com is the best way. You can just message me directly there. Yeah.
MichaelDonovanCoaching.com. And Jeff?
So you asked me this last time. I was like, man, I need to get a better professional Instagram account. So now you can find me at WilderDocJG on Instagram. And of course, I work with a company called Wild Health. And if you just search Wild Health, you'll find me under the providers there.
WilderDocJG. On Instagram and at Wild Health.
Yeah.
And at Wild Health also. Thank you guys so much for your expertise. Really appreciate the time. And for all of you, we will see you at the next show. Thanks for being here.
You have been listening to the Next Level Human podcast with Dr. Jade Tita. If you enjoyed this episode, please make sure you subscribe and consider leaving a review. You make the biggest difference when you pass on your lessons and inspire others. That's why reviews like this are so powerful. Your words may be the only ones that resonate for someone else. Please remember the information in this podcast is for educational purposes only. Always consult your personal physician or therapist before making any lifestyle changes. And finally, thank you for who you are in the world and the difference you make.